in the present. But does consciousness itself feel happy? Is it truly changed or colored by what it knows? In the teachings of Dzogchen, it is often said that thoughts and emotions arise in consciousness the way images appear on the surface of a mirror. This is only a metaphor, but it does capture an insight that one can have about the nature of the mind. Is a mirror improved by beautiful images? No. The same can be said for consciousness. Now think of something unpleasant. Perhaps you recently embarrassed yourself or received some bad news. Maybe there's an upcoming event about which you feel acutely anxious. Notice whatever feelings arise in the wake of these thoughts. They are also appearances in consciousness. Do they have the power to change what consciousness is in itself? There is real freedom to be found here, but you are unlikely to find it without looking carefully into the nature of consciousness again and again. Notice how thoughts continue to arise. Even while listening to this passage, your attention has surely strayed several times. Such wanderings of mind are the primary obstacle to meditation. Meditation doesn't entail the suppression of such thoughts, but it does require that we notice thoughts as they emerge and recognize them to be transitory appearances in consciousness. In subjective terms, you are consciousness itself. You are not the next evanescent image or string of words that appears in your mind. Not seeing it arise, however, the next thought will seem to become what you are. How could you actually be a thought? Whatever their content, thoughts vanish almost the instant they appear. They are like sounds or fleeting sensations in your body. How could this next thought define your subjectivity at all? It may take years of observing the contents of consciousness, or it may take only moments, but it is quite possible to realize that consciousness itself is free, no matter what arises to be noticed. Meditation is the practice of finding this freedom directly, by breaking one's identification with thought, and allowing the continuum of experience, pleasant and unpleasant, to simply be as it is. There are many traditional techniques for doing this, but it is important to realize that true meditation isn't an effort to produce a certain state of mind, like bliss or unusual visual images, or love for all sentient beings. Such methods exist, but they serve a more limited function. The deeper purpose of meditation is to recognize that which is common to all states of experience, both pleasant and unpleasant. The goal is to realize those qualities that are intrinsic to consciousness in every present moment, no matter what arises to be noticed. When you are able to rest naturally, merely witnessing the totality of experience, and thoughts themselves are left to arise and vanish as they will, you can recognize that consciousness is intrinsically undivided. In the moment of such an insight, you will be completely relieved of the feeling that you call I. You will still hear me speaking these words, of course, but they will be appearances in consciousness, inseparable from consciousness itself. And there will be no sense that you are in your head doing the listening. Such a shift in view isn't a matter of thinking new thoughts. It is easy enough to think that these sounds are just another appearance in consciousness. It is another matter to recognize them as such prior to the arising of thought. The gesture that precipitates this insight for most people is an attempt to invert consciousness upon itself, to look for that which is looking, and to notice, in the first instant of looking for yourself, what happens to the apparent divide between subject and object. Do you still feel that you are over there, behind your eyes, looking out at a world of objects? It really is possible to look for the feeling that you are calling I, and to fail to find it in a way that is conclusive. Having no head. Douglas Harding was a British architect who later in life became celebrated in New Age circles for having opened a novel doorway into the experience of selflessness. Raised among the exclusive Plymouth Brethren, a highly repressive sect of fundamentalist Christians, Harding apparently expressed his doubts with a fervor sufficient to get himself excommuted for apostasy. He later moved his family to India, where he spent years on a journey of self-discovery that culminated in an insight that he described as the state of, quote, having no head. I never met Harding, but after reading his books, I have little doubt that he was attempting to introduce his students to the same understanding that is the basis of Dzogchen practice. Harding was led to this insight after seeing a self-portrait of the Austrian physicist and philosopher Ernst Mach, who had the clever idea of drawing himself as he appeared from a first-person point of view. In a woodcut that Harding often referred to, you see Mock's body stretched out on a couch, and the view is framed by the side of his nose and his mustache. But otherwise, his head is invisible. Harding was inspired by this drawing to recognize that one's head is never visible when one looks out at the world. Harding later wrote several books about his experience, including a very useful little volume entitled On Having No Head. It is both amusing and instructive to note that his teachings were singled out for derision by the cognitive scientist Douglas Hofstetter, in collaboration with my friend Daniel Dennett, a man of wide learning and great intelligence, who, it would appear, did not understand what Harding was talking about. Here is a portion of Harding's text that Hofstetter criticized. What actually happened was something absurdly simple and unspectacular. I stopped thinking. A peculiar quiet, an odd kind of alert limpness and numbness came over me. Reason and imagination and all mental chatter died down. For once, words really failed me. Past and future dropped away. I forgot who and what I was, my name, manhood, animalhood, all that could be called mine. It was as if I had been born that instant, brand new, mindless, innocent of all memories. There existed only the now, that present moment and what was clearly given in it. To look was enough, and what I found was khaki trouser legs terminating downwards in a pair of brown shoes, khaki sleeves terminating sideways in a pair of pink hands, and a khaki shirt front terminating upwards in absolutely nothing whatsoever. Certainly not in a head. It took me no time at all to notice that this nothing, this hole where a head should have been, was no ordinary vacancy, no mere nothing. On the contrary, it was very much occupied. It was a vast emptiness vastly filled, a nothing that found room for everything, room for grass, trees, shadowy distant hills, and far above them snow peaks like a row of angular clouds riding the blue sky. I had lost a head and gained a world. Here it was, this superb scene, brightly shining in the clear air, alone and unsupported, mysteriously suspended in the void, and this was the real miracle, the wonder and delight, utterly free of me, unstained by any observer. Its total presence was my total absence, body and soul. Lighter than air, clearer than glass, altogether released from myself. I was nowhere around. There arose no questions, no reference beyond the experience itself, but only peace and a quiet joy, and the sensation of having dropped an intolerable burden. I had been blind to the one thing that is always present, and without which I am blind indeed to this marvelous substitute for a head, this unbounded clarity, this luminous and absolutely pure void, which nevertheless is, rather than contains, all things. For however carefully I attend, I fail to find even so much as a blank screen on which these mountains and sun and sky are projected, or a clear mirror in which they are reflected, or a transparent lens or aperture through which they are viewed, still less a soul or a mind to which they are presented, or a viewer, however shadowy, who is distinguishable from the view. Nothing whatever intervenes, not even that baffling and elusive obstacle called distance. The huge blue sky, the pink-edged whiteness of the snows, the sparkling green of the grass. How can these be remote when there's nothing to be remote from? The headless void refuses all definition and location. It is not round or small or big or even here as distinct from there. Harding's assertion that he has no head must be read in the first-person sense. The man was not claiming to have been literally decapitated. From a first-person point of view, his emphasis on headlessness is a stroke of genius that offers an unusually clear description of what it's like to glimpse the non-duality of consciousness. Here are Hofstetter's reflections on Harding's account. We have here been presented with a charmingly childish and solipsistic view of the human condition. It is something that, at an intellectual level, offends and appalls us. Can anyone sincerely entertain such notions without embarrassment? Yet to some primitive level in us, it speaks clearly. This is the level at which we cannot accept the notion of our own death. Having expressed his pity for batty old Harding, Hofstetter proceeds to explain away his insights as a solipsistic denial of mortality, a perpetuation of the childish illusion that, quote, I am a necessary ingredient of the universe, end quote. However, Harding's point was that I is not even an ingredient, necessary or otherwise, of his own mind. What Hofstadter fails to realize is that Harding's account contains a precise, empirical instruction. Look for whatever it is you are calling I, without being distracted by even the subtlest undercurrent of thought, and notice what happens the moment you turn consciousness upon itself. This illustrates a very common phenomenon in scientific and secular circles. We have a contemplative like Harding, who, to the eye of anyone familiar with the experience of self-transcendence, has described it in a manner approaching perfect clarity. We also have a scholar like Hofstadter, a celebrated contributor to our modern understanding of the mind, who dismisses him as a child. Before rejecting Harding's account as merely silly, you should investigate this experience for yourself. Look for your head. As you gaze at the world around you, take a moment to look for your head. This may seem like a bizarre instruction. You might think, "Of course I can't see my head. What's so interesting about that?" Not so fast. Simply look at the world, or at other people, and attempt to turn your attention in the direction of where you know your head to be. For instance, if you're having a conversation with another person, see if you can let your attention travel in the direction of the other person's gaze. He is looking at your face, and you cannot see your face. The only face present, from your point of view, belongs to the other person. But looking for yourself in this way can precipitate a sudden change in perspective of the sort Harding describes. Some people find it easier to trigger this shift in a slightly different way. As you are looking out at the world, simply imagine that you have no head. Whichever method you choose, don't struggle with this exercise. It is not a matter of going deep within or of producing some extraordinary experience. The view of headlessness is right on the surface of consciousness and can be glimpsed the moment you attempt to turn about. Pay attention to how the world appears in the first instant, not after a protracted effort. Either you will see it immediately or you won't see it at all, and the resulting glimpse of open awareness will last only a moment or two before thoughts intervene. Simply repeat this glimpse, again and again, in as relaxed a way as possible as you go about your day. Once again, selflessness is not a deep feature of consciousness. It is right on the surface, and yet people can meditate for years without recognizing it. After I was introduced to the practice of Dzogchen, I realized that much of my time spent meditating had been a way of actively overlooking the very insight I was seeking. How can something be right on the surface of experience and yet be difficult to see? I've already drawn the analogy to the optic blind spot, but other analogies may give a clearer sense of the subtle shift in attention that is required to see what is right before one's eyes. We've all had the experience of looking through a window and suddenly noticing our own reflection in the glass. At that moment, we have a choice, to use the window as a window and to see the world beyond, or to use it as a mirror. It is extraordinarily easy to shift back and forth between these two views, but impossible to truly focus on both simultaneously. This shift offers a very good analogy, both for what it is like to recognize the illusoriness of the self for the first time, and for why it can take so long to do it. Imagine that you want to show another person how a window can also function like a mirror. As it happens, your friend has never seen this effect and is quite skeptical of your claims. You direct her attention to the largest window in your house, and although the conditions are perfect for seeing her reflection, she immediately becomes captivated by the world outside. What a beautiful view! Who are your neighbors? Is that a redwood or a Douglas fir? You begin to speak about there being two views and about the fact that your friend's reflection stands before her even now. But she notices only that your neighbor's dog has slipped out the front door and is now dashing down the sidewalk. In every moment, it is clear to you that your friend is staring directly through the image of her face without seeing it. Of course, you could easily direct her attention to the surface of the window by touching the glass with your hand. This would be akin to the pointing out instruction of Dzogchen. However, here the analogy begins to break down. It is very difficult to imagine someone's not being able to see her reflection in a window even after years of looking. But that is what happens when a person begins most forms of spiritual practice. Most techniques of meditation are, in essence, elaborate ways of looking through the window, in the hope that if one only sees the world in greater detail, an image of one's true face will eventually appear. Imagine a teaching like this. If you just focus on the trees swaying outside the window without distraction, you will see your true face. Undoubtedly, such an instruction would be an obstacle to seeing what could otherwise be seen directly. Almost everything that has been said or written about spiritual practice even most of the teachings one finds in Buddhism, directs a person's gaze to the world beyond the glass, thereby confusing matters from the very beginning. But one must start somewhere, and the truth is that most people are simply too distracted by their thoughts to have the selflessness of consciousness pointed out directly. And even if they are ready to glimpse it, they are unlikely to understand its significance. Harding confessed that many of his students recognize the state of headlessness only to say, "So what?" It is, in fact, very difficult to deal with this "so what." That is why certain traditions, like Dzogchen, consider teachings about the intrinsic non-duality of consciousness to be secret, reserving them for students who have spent considerable time practicing other forms of meditation. On one level, the requirement that a person have mastered other preliminary practices is purely pragmatic. For unless she has the requisite concentration and mindfulness to actually follow the teacher's instructions, she is liable to be lost in thought and understand nothing at all. But there is another purpose to withholding these non-dual teachings. Unless a person has spent some time seeking self-transcendence dualistically, she is unlikely to recognize that the brief glimpse of selflessness is actually the answer to her search. Having then said "so what" in the face of the highest teachings, there is nothing for her to do but persist in her confusion. The paradox of acceptance. It would seem that very few good things in life come from our accepting the present moment as it is. To become educated, we must be motivated to learn. To master a sport requires that we continually improve our performance and overcome our resistance to physical exertion. To be a better spouse or parent, we must often make deliberate effort to change ourselves. Merely accepting that we are lazy, distracted, petty, easily provoked to anger, and inclined to waste our time in ways that we will later regret is not a path to happiness. And yet it is true that meditation requires total acceptance of what is given in the present moment. If you are injured and in pain, the path to mental peace can be traversed in a single step. Simply accept the pain as it arises, while doing whatever you need to do to help your body heal. If you are anxious before giving a speech, become willing to feel the anxiety fully, so that it becomes a meaningless pattern of energy in your mind and body. Embracing the contents of consciousness in any moment is a very powerful way of training yourself to respond differently to adversity. However, it is important to distinguish between accepting unpleasant sensations and emotions as a strategy, while covertly hoping that they will go away, and truly accepting them as transitory appearances in consciousness. Only the latter gesture opens the door to wisdom and lasting change. The paradox is that we can become wiser and more compassionate and live more fulfilling lives by refusing to be who we have tended to be in the past. But we must also relax, accepting things as they are in the present, as we strive to change ourselves. Chapter 5. Gurus, Death, Drugs, and Other Puzzles. One of the first obstacles encountered along any contemplative path is the basic uncertainty about the nature of spiritual authority. If there are important truths to be discovered through introspection, there must be better and worse ways to do this, and one should expect to meet a range of experts, novices, fools, and frauds along the way. Of course, charlatans haunt every walk of life, but on spiritual matters, foolishness and fraudulence can be especially difficult to detect. Unfortunately, this is a natural consequence of the subject matter. When learning to play a sport like golf, you can immediately establish the abilities of the teacher, and the teacher can, in turn, evaluate your progress without leaving anything to the imagination. All the relevant facts are in plain view. If you can't consistently hit the little white ball where you want it to go, you have something to learn from anybody who can. The difference between an expert and a novice is no less stark when it comes to recognizing the illusion of the self, but the qualifications of a teacher and the progress of a student are more difficult to assess. Spiritual teachers of a certain ability, whether real or imagined, are often described as gurus, and they elicit an unusual degree of devotion from their students. If your golf instructor were to insist that you shave your head, sleep no more than 4 hours each night, renounce sex, and subsist on a diet of raw vegetables, you would find a new golf instructor. However, when gurus make demands of this kind, many of their students simply do as directed. In the West, the term guru immediately conjures the image of a surrounding cult of devotees, a situation known to give rise to terrifying social deformities. in cults and other fringe spiritual communities, we often find a collection of needy and credulous dropouts ruled by a charismatic psychotic or psychopath. When we consider groups like the People's Temple under Jim Jones, the Branch Davidians under David Koresh, and Heaven's Gate under Marshall Applewhite, it is almost impossible to understand how the spell was first cast, let alone how it was maintained under conditions of such terrible deprivation and danger. But each of these groups proved that intellectual isolation and abuse can lead even well-educated people to willingly destroy themselves. Gurus fall at every point along the spectrum of moral wisdom. Charles Manson was a guru of sorts. Jesus, the Buddha, Muhammad, Joseph Smith, and every other patriarch and matriarch of the world's religions were as well. For our purposes, the only difference between a cult and a religion are the numbers of adherents and the degree to which they are marginalized by the rest of society. Scientology remains a cult. Mormonism has, just barely, become a religion. Christianity has been a religion for more than 1,000 years, but one searches in vain for differences in their respective doctrines that account for the differences in their status. Some gurus claim to channel the dead, to be poised to leave Earth on an alien spacecraft, or to have once ruled Atlantis. Others impart perfectly reasonable teachings about the nature of the mind and the causes of human suffering, only to make ridiculous claims about cosmology or the origins of disease. To hear that someone is a guru tells us almost nothing apart from the fact that some students hold this person in high esteem, whether their reasons for doing so are good or bad, and whether these people pose a danger to their neighbors depends upon the content of their beliefs. Teachers in any field can help or harm their students, and a person's desire to make progress and to win the teacher's approval can often be exploited emotionally, financially, or sexually. But a guru purports to teach the very art of living, and thus his beliefs potentially encompass every question relevant to the well-being of his students. Apart from parenthood, probably no human relationship offers greater scope for benevolence or abuse than that of guru to disciple. Unsurprisingly, therefore, the ethical failures of the men and women who assume this role can be spectacular and constitute some of the greatest examples of hypocrisy and betrayal to be found anywhere. The problem of trust is compounded because the line between valid instruction and abuse can be difficult to discern. Given that the entire purpose of a devotee's relationship to a guru is to have his egocentric illusions exposed and undermined, any unwelcome intrusion into his life can potentially be justified as a teaching. Here's a quote from the Zen literature. Whenever Gutei Osho was asked about Zen, he simply raised his finger. Once a visitor asked Gute's boy attendant, "What does your master teach?" The boy, too, raised his finger. Hearing of this, Gute cut off the boy's finger with a knife. The boy, screaming with pain, began to run away. Gute called to him, and when he turned around, Gute raised his finger. The boy suddenly became enlightened. If cutting off a child's finger can count as compassionate instruction, it seems impossible to predict how fully a spiritual teacher might depart from conventional ethical norms. This is both a theoretical problem in the literature and a psychological one in many spiritual communities. A student's moral intuitions and instincts for self-preservation can always be recast as symptoms of fear and attachment. Consequently, even the most extraordinarily cruel or degrading treatment at the hands of a guru can be interpreted as being for one's own good. The master wants to have sex with you and your spouse. Why would you resist? Can't you see that your impulse to refuse such a generous overture rests on the very illusion of separateness that you want to overcome? Oh, you don't fancy tithing 20% of your income to the ashram? Why are you so attached to the fruits of your own labor? What is enlightenment worth to you anyway? You don't like scrubbing toilets and doing yard work for hours at a stretch? Are you above performing such simple acts of service to the divine? Don't you see that this feeling of self-importance is precisely what must be surrendered before you can recognize your true nature? You found it humiliating when the master had you strip naked and dance in front of your parents and the rest of the congregation? Can't you see that this was just a mirror held up to expose your own egocentricity? Oh, you don't think an enlightened adept would behave this way? Well, what makes you think your provincial assumptions about enlightenment are true? Given the structure of this game, it is little wonder that many people have been harmed by their relationships to spiritual teachers, or that many teachers, given so much power over the lives of others, have abused it. This ethical terrain is all the more confusing because there is no cult leader so deranged or sadistic, or whose fall from grace was so hideous, that one can't find students who will insist that he or she is the Messiah. It is amazing to consider, but there are people still walking this earth who believe that Jim Jones, David Koresh, and Marshall Applewhite were genuine saviors. It is also safe to say that no teacher has been so saintly and impeccable that someone hasn't left his company convinced that he was a dangerous lunatic. If every guru were judged by the worst thing anyone had ever said about him, none would escape hanging. It is true, however, that the role of guru seems to attract more than its fair share of narcissists and confidence men. Again, this seems to be a natural consequence of the subject matter. One can't fake being an expert gymnast, a rocket scientist, or even a competent cook, at least not for long. But one can fake being an enlightened adept. Those who succeed in doing this are often quite charismatic, because a person can't survive long in this mode unless he can bowl people over. G.I. Gurdjieff set the standard here, and he may have been the first man to return from his travels to the East and establish himself as a proper guru in the West. He was the classic example of a gifted charlatan. He managed to attract a wide following of smart, successful devotees, including the French mathematician Henri Poincaré, the painter Georgia O'Keeffe, and the authors J.B. Priestley, René de Mol, and Catherine Mansfield. He reached other luminaries as well, including Aldous Huxley, T.S. Eliot, and Gerald Hurd, through the efforts of his main disciple, P.D. Uspensky. Frank Lloyd Wright once declared Gurdjieff, quote, the greatest man in the world. Coming from a narcissist of Wright's caliber, this says quite a lot about what sort of impression the man could make. However, Gurdjieff taught his students that the moon was alive, that it controlled the thoughts and behaviors of unenlightened people, and that it devoured their souls at the moment of death. He used to make visitors to his chateau in Fontainebleau spend long days digging ditches in the sun, only to have them immediately fill them in again and begin digging elsewhere. He must have made quite an impression in person, given how long he was able to get away with this mischief. I'm confident that if I were to teach a similarly insane doctrine, all the while demanding painful and pointless sacrifices from my students, I wouldn't have a friend left on earth by the end of the week. I'm not saying that being forced to do hard and seemingly useless work cannot benefit a person. Consider the Navy SEALs. To become a SEAL, every candidate must pass a qualifying course so arduous that it would constitute torture if imposed on him against his will. This is a selection process that allows the U.S. Navy to produce the most elite special operations force found anywhere. But it is also a bad selection process that serves primarily as a rite of passage. It is well known, for instance, that some of the best recruits to the SEAL program are weeded out owing to sheer bad luck. They simply suffer too many injuries to continue with the training, or to survive Hell Week, a 5.5-day purgatory of wet sand, dangerous boat drills, calisthenics, hypothermia, and sleeplessness. But those left standing have had an experience of self-overcoming unknown to humanity outside of ancient Sparta, and they can be sure that everyone else with whom they will serve in combat has survived the same ordeal. One of the first things one learns in practicing meditation is that nothing is intrinsically boring. Indeed, boredom is simply a lack of attention. Pay sufficient attention, and the mere experience of breathing can reward months and years of steady vigilance. Every guru knows that drudgery can be a way of testing the strength of this insight. And, needless to say, this truth about the human mind can be exploited. The journalist Francis Fitzgerald recounts meeting many well-educated disciples of Osho, Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh, doctors, lawyers, engineers, professors, doing years of uncompensated menial labor at his Oregon commune. All appeared quite happy with the work, presumably viewing it as an exercise in self-overcoming. Indeed, abandoning one's worldly ambitions to do menial labor, attentively and joyfully, can be an exercise in self-overcoming. Here, two truths apparently collide. A person can be exploited and still learn something valuable in the process. But one must draw the line somewhere, and I think consent should be the governing principle. SEALs in training can drop out at any time, and they are continually encouraged to do so. The inner voice that says they might not have what it takes to be a SEAL is deliberately amplified by their instructors, often by bullhorn, so that those who don't have what it takes will leave the program. That is what distinguishes SEAL training from actual torture. Cults, by contrast, often violate the principle of consent in many ways. I don't deny that a truly enlightened man or woman, that is one who has fully and permanently unraveled the conventional sense of self, might awaken his or her students by violating certain moral and cultural norms. But extreme examples of such unconventional behavior often referred to in the literature as crazy wisdom, seem to produce the desired result only in the literature. Every modern instance of these shenanigans has seemed far more crazy than wise, attesting to nothing so much as the insecurities and sensual desires of the guru in question. Ancient tales of liberating violence, as in the Zen parable I just read, or of enlightening sexual exploits, seem like literary teaching devices, not accurate accounts of how wisdom has been reliably transmitted from master to disciple. It is usually easy to detect social and psychological problems in any community of spiritual seekers. This seems to be yet another liability inherent to the project of self-transcendence. Many people renounce the world because they can't find a satisfactory place in it, and almost any spiritual teaching can be used to justify a pathological lack of ambition. For someone who has not yet succeeded at anything, and who probably fears failure, a doctrine that criticizes the search for worldly success can be very appealing. And devotion to a guru, a combination of love, gratitude, awe, and obedience, can facilitate an unhealthy return to childhood. In fact, the very structure of this relationship can condemn a student to a kind of intellectual and emotional slavery. The writer Peter Marin captured the mood perfectly. Obedience to a perfect master. One could hear, inwardly in them, the gathering of breath for a collective sigh of relief. At last, to be set free, to lay down one's burden, to be a child again, not in renewed innocence, but in restored dependence, in admitted, undisguised dependence, to be told again what to do and how to do it. The yearning in the audience was so palpable, their need so thick and obvious, that it was impossible not to feel it, impossible not to empathize with it in some way. Why not, after all? Clearly there are truths and kinds of wisdom to which most persons will not come alone. Clearly there are in the world authorities in matters of the spirit, seasoned travelers, guides. Somewhere there must be truths, other than the disappointing ones we have. Somewhere there must be access to a world larger than this one. And if, to get there, we must put aside all arrogance of will and the stubborn ego, why not? Why not admit that we do not know and cannot do and submit to someone who both knows and does, who will teach us if we merely put aside all judgment for the moment and obey with trust and goodwill? A relationship with a guru, or indeed with any expert, tends to run along authoritarian lines. You don't know what you need to know, and the expert presumably does. That's why you're sitting in front of him in the first place. The implied hierarchy is unavoidable. Contemplative expertise exists, and a contemplative expert is someone who can help you realize certain truths about the nature of your own mind. Unfortunately, the link between self-transcendence and moral behavior is not as straightforward as we might like. It would seem that some people can have genuine spiritual insights and a capacity to provoke these insights in others, while harboring serious moral flaws. It is not always accurate to call such people frauds. They aren't necessarily pretending to have spiritual insights, or to be able to produce such experiences in others. But depending on the level of their practice, their insights may be an insufficient antidote to the rest of their personalities. The resulting problems can be accentuated by cultural differences. For instance, what is the age of consent for sex? One wouldn't necessarily get the same answers in Bombay and Boston. Certain schools of Buddhism focus on compassion, kindness, and non-harming to an unusual degree, and this offers some protection against abuses of power. But even here, one occasionally finds a venerated master with the ethical intuitions of a pirate. Consider the case of the late Tibetan Lama Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, who was an inspired teacher, but also an occasionally violent drunk and philanderer. As guru to Allen Ginsberg, Trungpa attracted many of America's most accomplished poets into his orbit. Once at a Halloween party for senior students, where W.S. Merwin, the future poet laureate of the United States, and his girlfriend, the poet Dana Naoni, were guests. Trungpa ordered his bodyguards to forcibly strip a 60-year-old woman of her clothing and carry her naked around the meditation hall. This made Merwin and Naoni more than a little uncomfortable, and they thought it wise to return to their room for the rest of the night. Noticing their absence, Trungpa asked a group of devotees to find the poets and bring them back to the party. When Merwin and Naoni refused to open their door, Trungpa instructed his disciples to break it down. The resulting forced entry led to chaos, wherein Merwin, who was then famous for his pacifism, fought off his attackers with a broken beer bottle, stabbing several in the face and arms. The sight of blood, and his horror over his own actions, apparently collapsed Merwin's defenses, and he and Naoni finally allowed themselves to be captured and brought before the guru. Trungpa, who was by then quite drunk, castigated the pair for their egocentricity and demanded that they take off their clothes. When they refused, he ordered his bodyguards to strip them. By all accounts, Naoni became hysterical and begged someone among the crowd of onlookers to call the police. One student attempted to physically intervene. Trungpa himself punched this Samaritan in the face and then ordered his guards to drag the man from the room. Predictably, many of Trungpa's students viewed the assault on Merwin and Naoni as a profound spiritual teaching, meant to subdue their egos. Ginsburg, who was not present at the time, offered the following assessment in an interview. In the middle of that scene, to yell, "Call the police, do you realize how vulgar that was? The wisdom of the East was being unveiled, and she's going, call the police. I mean, shit, fuck that shit. Strip him naked, break down the door." Apart from having produced a perfect jewel of hippie moral confusion, Ginsburg exposed the riddle at the heart of the traditional guru-devotee relationship. No doubt Merwin and Naoni's preference to not dance naked in public had more than a little to do with their attachment to their own privacy and autonomy. And it isn't inconceivable that a guru could operate in such a coercive and seemingly unethical way out of a sense of compassion. In fact, it may have been conceivable to Merwin and Naoni themselves, even in the aftermath of this humiliating ordeal, because they remained at Trungpa's seminar for several more days to receive further teachings. However, judging from the effect that Trungpa's wild behavior had on both himself, he apparently died from alcoholism, and his students, it is very difficult to view it as the product of enlightened wisdom. The scandals surrounding Trungpa's organization did not end there. Trungpa had groomed a Western student, Lissel Tenzin, to be his successor. Tenzin was the first Westerner to be honored in this way in any lineage of Tibetan Buddhism. His appointment as Vajra regent had been approved by the Karmapa, one of the most revered Tibetan masters then living. As it happens, Tenzin was bisexual, highly promiscuous, and rather fond of pressuring his straight male devotees to have sex with him as a form of spiritual initiation. He later contracted HIV, but continued to have unprotected sex with more than 100 men and women without telling them of his condition. Trungpa and several people on the board of his organization knew that the regent was ill and did their best to keep it a secret. Once the scandal broke, Tenzin claimed that Trungpa promised him that he would do no harm as long as he continued his spiritual practice. Apparently, the virus in his blood didn't care whether he did his spiritual practice or not. At least one of his victims later died of AIDS, having spread HIV to others. What one encounters in a person like Trungpa is a mind impressively free of shame. This can be a good thing, provided that one happens to also be committed to the well-being of others. But shame serves a crucial social function. It keeps us from behaving like wild animals. Believing in one's own perfect enlightenment is rather like driving a car without brakes. Not a problem if you never need to stop or slow down, but otherwise a terrible idea. The belief that he could live beyond conventional moral constraints is explicitly put forward in Trungpa's teaching. Morality or discipline is not a matter of binding oneself to a fixed set of laws or patterns. For if a bodhisattva is completely selfless, a completely open person, then he will act according to openness and will not have to follow rules. He will simply fall into patterns. It is impossible for the bodhisattva to destroy or harm other people because he embodies transcendental generosity. He has opened himself completely and so does not discriminate between this and that. He just acts in accordance with what is. If we are completely open, not watching ourselves at all, but being completely open and communicating with situations as they are, then action is pure, absolute, superior. It is an often used metaphor that the bodhisattva's conduct is like the walk of an elephant. Elephants do not hurry. They just walk slowly and surely through the jungle, one step after another. They just sail right along. They never fall, nor do they make mistakes. The state of freedom and effortless goodwill that Trungpa describes here undoubtedly corresponds to an experience that certain people have and to a perception, whether true or not, that others can form about them. But boundless compassion is one thing, inerrancy is another. The notion that one is incapable of making mistakes poses obvious ethical concerns, no matter what one's level of realization. Anyone who has studied the spread of Eastern spirituality in the West knows that these elephants often stumble, even stampede, injuring themselves and many others in the process. A person's eyes convey a powerful illusion of inner life. The illusion is true, but it is an illusion all the same. When we look into the eyes of another human being, we seem to see the light of consciousness radiating from the eyes themselves. There's a glint of joy or judgment, perhaps. But every inflection of mood or personality, even the most basic indication that the person is alive, comes not from the eyes but from the surrounding muscles of the face. If a person's eyes look clouded by madness or fatigue, the muscles orbicularis oculi are to blame. And if a person appears to radiate the wisdom of the ages, the effect comes not from the eyes but from what he or she is doing with them. Nevertheless, the illusion is a powerful one. And there's no question that the subjective experience of inner radiance can be communicated with the gaze. It is not an accident, therefore, that gurus often show an unusual commitment to maintaining eye contact. In the best case, this behavior emerges from a genuine comfort in the presence of other people and a deep interest in their well-being. Given such a frame of mind, there may simply be no reason to look away. But maintaining eye contact can also become a way of, quote, acting spiritual, and therefore an intrusive affectation. There are also people who maintain rigid eye lock, not from an attitude of openness and interest, or from any attempt to appear open and interested, but as an aggressive and narcissistic show of dominance. Psychopaths tend to make exceptionally good eye contact. Whatever the motive behind it, there can be a tremendous power in an unwavering gaze. Most of you will know what I'm talking about, but if you want to witness a glorious example of the assertive grandiosity that a person's eyes can convey, watch a few interviews with Osho. I never met Osho, but I've met many people like him, and the way he plays the game of eye contact is simply hilarious. I confess that there was a period in my life, after I first plunged into matters spiritual, when I became a nuisance in this respect. Wherever I went, no matter how superficial the exchange, I gazed into the eyes of everyone I met as though they were my long-lost lover. No doubt many people found this more than a bit creepy. Others considered it a stark provocation, but it also precipitated exchanges with complete strangers that were fascinating. With some regularity, people of both sexes seemed to become bewitched by me on the basis of a single conversation. Had I been peddling some consoling philosophy and been eager to gather students, I suspect that I could have made a proper mess of things. I definitely glimpsed the path that many spiritual imposters have taken throughout history. Interestingly, when one functions in this mode, one quickly recognizes all the other people who are playing the same game. I had many encounters wherein I would meet the eyes of a person across the room, and suddenly we were playing War of the Warlocks, two strangers holding each other's gaze well past the point that our primate genes or cultural conditioning would ordinarily countenance. Play this game long enough and you begin to have some very strange encounters. I don't remember consciously deciding to stop behaving this way, but stop I did. Nevertheless, it is worth paying attention to the type of eye contact one makes. As I already noted, the discomfort one feels when meeting another's gaze seems like nothing more than a ramification of the very feeling of being a self. For this reason, open-eyed meditation with another person can be a very powerful practice. When one overcomes the resistance to staring into another person's eyes, the absence of self-consciousness can be especially vivid. Eye contact meditation. Sit across from your partner and simply stare into each other's eyes. Depending on how far apart you sit, you might have to pick one eye to focus on. Continue to hold each other's gaze without speaking. Ignore laughter and other signs of discomfort. This practice can be combined with other techniques described in this book, especially mindfulness of breathing and Douglas Harding's inquiry into headlessness. Witnessing the misadventures of supposedly enlightened adepts and their devotees can be depressing, but it can also be amusing. I wrote about one such example in my first book, The End of Faith. I know a group of veteran spiritual seekers who, after searching for a teacher among the caves and dells of the Himalayas for many months, finally discovered a Hindu yogi who seemed qualified to lead them into the ethers. He was as thin as Jesus, as limber as an orangutan, and wore his hair matted down to his knees. They promptly brought this prodigy to America to instruct them in the ways of spiritual devotion. After a suitable period of acculturation, our ascetic, who was, incidentally, both admired for his physical beauty and for the manner in which he played the drum, decided that sex with the prettiest of his patron's wives would suit his pedagogical purposes admirably. These relations were commenced at once, and endured for some time by a man whose devotion to wife and guru, it must be said, was now being sorely tested. His wife, if I'm not mistaken, was an enthusiastic participant in this, quote, tantric exercise. For her guru was both fully enlightened and as dashing a swain as Lord Krishna. Gradually, this saintly man further refined his spiritual requirements, as well as his appetites. The day soon dawned when he would eat nothing for breakfast but a pint of Haagen-Dazs vanilla ice cream topped with cashews. We might well imagine that the meditations of a cuckold, wandering the frozen food aisles of a supermarket in search of an enlightened man's enlightened repast, were anything but devotional. This guru was soon sent back to India with his drum. Ice cream for breakfast. That may tell us everything we need to know. And yet there is no way around the fact that in spiritual matters, as in all others, we must seek instruction from those whom we deem to be more accomplished than ourselves, and the signs of accomplishment are not always clear. With spirituality, the subject matter and the apparent distance between teacher and student seem to create the perfect conditions for self-deception, and thus for misplaced and exploited trust. It is possible, however, with a bit of luck and discrimination, to bypass such problems while still receiving teachings from those who are wiser and more experienced in these matters than oneself. I offer my own case as a not entirely unusual example. Throughout my 20s, I studied with many teachers who functioned as gurus in the traditional sense, but I never had a relationship with any of them that I find embarrassing in retrospect, or that I wouldn't currently recommend to others. I don't know whether to attribute this to good luck or to the fact that there was a line of devotion I was never tempted to cross. Traditionally, one is admonished to view one's guru as perfect. I confess that I could never take this advice seriously, other than in the trivial sense that consciousness itself might be considered perfect in some way, or that a perfect realization of its intrinsic freedom might be possible. Despite how impressive many of my teachers were, they were undoubtedly human and susceptible to the same cultural biases and physical infirmities that define the lives of ordinary people. For instance, when it came time for Punjaji to marry off his niece, he could think of nothing more enlightened than to publish her picture in the single section of the local newspaper, after having paid a photographer to lighten the color of her skin by several shades. This practice was ubiquitous in India at the time, and considered entirely normal. To my eye, however, it was at once deceitful, demeaning, and expressive of bigotry toward people with dark skin. I could only conclude that either enlightenment failed to clear the mind of such cultural residues, or Punjaji had yet to achieve full enlightenment. In either case, I couldn't view his solution to the problem of marriage as perfect. The gurus I have met personally, as well as those whose careers and teachings I have studied at a distance, range from crooks who could be quickly dismissed, to teachers who were brilliant but flawed, to those who, while still human, seemed to possess so much compassion and clarity of mind that they were nearly flawless examples of the benefits of spiritual practice. This last group is of obvious interest, and these are surely the people one hopes to meet, but the middle group can be helpful as well. Some teachers about whom depressing stories are told, men and women whose indiscretions may seem to discredit the very concept of spiritual authority, are in fact talented contemplatives. Many of these people get corrupted by the power and opportunities that come with inspiring devotion in others. Some may begin to believe the myths that grow up around them, and some are guilty of ludicrous exaggerations of their own spiritual and historical significance. Caveat emptor. Of course, there can be clear indications that a teacher is not worth paying attention to. A history as a fabulist or con artist should be considered fatal. Thus, the spiritual opinions of Joseph Smith, Gurdjieff, and L. Ron Hubbard can be safely ignored. A fetish for numbers is also an ominous sign. Math is magical, but math approached like magic is just superstition. And numerology is where the intellect goes to die. Prophecy is also a very strong indication of chicanery or madness on the part of the teacher, and of stupidity among his students. One can extrapolate from scientific data or technological trends, climate models, Moore's law, but most detailed predictions about the future lead to embarrassment right on schedule. Anyone who can confidently tell you what the world will be like in 2027 is delusional. The channeling of invisible entities, whether broadcast from beyond the grave or from another galaxy, should provoke only laughter. J.Z. Knight, who has long claimed to be the mouthpiece for a 35,000-year-old entity named Ramtha, is the ultimate example of how you don't want your teacher to sound. And any suggestion that a guru has influenced world events through magic should also put an end to the conversation. Sri Aurobindo and his partner, known as the Mother, apparently claimed to have decided the outcome of World War II with their psychic powers. In that case, one wonders why they weren't held morally responsible for not having ended it sooner. Yet another reason to ignore Aurobindo's long, unreadable books. Generally speaking, you should head for the door at any sign of deception on the part of a teacher. Admittedly, you might want to make certain allowances for cultural differences and for the harmlessness of the lie. On one occasion, a very great Dzogchen master, truly one of the most inspiring people I've ever met, declared that a certain day of our retreat would be one of vegetarian austerity, which, from a Tibetan point of view, was an actual sacrifice. Sometime after lunch, I entered his room and caught him in flagrante delicto, furtively eating a steak out of tin foil. The moment he saw me, this devilish old lama wadded the foil into a ball and chucked it to his wife like a quarterback delivering a lateral pass. She then hurled it across the room, where it made a distinctly moist thud in the back of a closet. Needless to say, we all had a very good laugh over these machinations, and it was not the sort of deception that seemed calculated to manipulate students or to falsely elevate the status of the teacher. In fact, this teacher did not elevate himself at all, a quality that can compensate for many other sins. I have never encountered a spiritual teacher who I thought was fully enlightened in the sense that many Buddhists and Hindus imagine is possible, that is, stably free of the illusion of the self and endowed with clairvoyance and other miraculous powers. While I remain open to evidence of psi phenomenon, clairvoyance, telepathy, and so forth, the fact that they haven't been conclusively demonstrated in the lab is a very strong indication that they do not exist. Researchers who study these things allege that the data are there, and that proof of psi can be seen in departures from randomness that occur over thousands of experimental trials. But people who believe that their guru has supernormal powers aren't thinking in terms of weak statistical effects. They believe that a specific person can reliably read minds, heal the sick, and work other miracles. I have yet to see a case in which evidence for such abilities was presented in a credible way. If one person on Earth possessed psychic powers to any significant degree, this would be among the easiest facts to authenticate in a lab. Many people have been duped by traditional evasions on this point. It's often said, for instance, that demonstrating such powers on demand would be spiritually uncouth, and that to even want such empirical evidence is an unflattering sign of doubt on the part of a student. "Except ye see signs and wonders, ye will not believe." John 4:48. A lifetime of foolishness and self-deception awaits anyone who won't call this bluff. But one need not believe in psychic powers to cut through the illusion of the self. Accomplishing this can be elusive enough. If I've ever met a person who has done so perfectly, I am unaware of it. I have studied with several people who were assumed to be fully enlightened in that sense, and even some who made the claim explicitly. But as far as I can tell, this added nothing of value to their teachings, while introducing a distracting note of grandiosity into the conversation. Whether or not it's possible for someone to have a permanent experience of self-transcendence, a student's conviction that a teacher is fully enlightened seems superfluous, and it is usually cast in doubt by something silly the teacher says or does in any case. Once again, I believe that too much can be made of the failures of spiritual teachers or of the pathologies found among their followers, as though such pratfalls discredit the guru-disciple relationship in principle. One might draw a useful analogy to marriage here. Examples of bad marriages, or at least unenviable ones, are everywhere to be seen, and few seem to live up to the institution's promise. Focusing on scenes of domestic misery, one might easily conclude that the very idea of marriage is flawed, and that human beings should find a better way to arrange themselves and to raise children. I think this conclusion would be reckless. Although I have yet to find a spiritual community that appeared worth joining, and signs of trouble are very easy to spot, I have known many people who learned a great deal by spending extended periods of time in the company of one or another spiritual teacher, and I have learned indispensable things myself. All this may raise a concern about whether the ideal of enlightenment is a false one. Is true freedom even possible? It certainly is in a momentary sense, as any mature practitioner of meditation knows, and those moments can increase in both number and duration with practice. Therefore, I see no reason why a person couldn't perfectly banish the illusion of the self. However, just the ability to meditate, to rest as consciousness for a few moments prior to the arising of the next thought, can offer a profound relief from mental suffering. We need not come to the end of the path to experience the benefits of walking it. Mind on the brink of death. One cannot travel far in spiritual circles without meeting people who are fascinated by the, quote, near-death experience, abbreviated as NDE. The phenomenon has been described as follows. Frequently recurring features include feelings of peace and joy, a sense of being out of one's body and watching events going on around one's body and, occasionally, at some distant physical location, a cessation of pain, seeing a dark tunnel or void, seeing an unusually bright light, sometimes experienced as a, quote, being of light that radiates love and may speak or otherwise communicate with the person, encountering other beings, often deceased persons whom the experiencer recognizes, experiencing a revival of memories, or even a full life review, sometimes accompanied by feelings of judgment, seeing some other realm, often of great beauty, sensing a barrier or border beyond which the person cannot go, and returning to the body, often reluctantly. Such accounts have led many people to believe that consciousness must be independent of the brain. However, these experiences vary across cultures, and no single feature is common to them all. One would think that if a non-physical domain were truly being explored, some universal characteristics would stand out. Hindus and Christians would not substantially disagree, and one certainly wouldn't expect the after-death state of South Indians to diverge from that of North Indians, as has been reported. It should also trouble NDE enthusiasts that only 10 to 20% of people who approach clinical death recall having any experience at all. But the deepest problem with drawing sweeping conclusions about the NDE is that those who have had one and subsequently talked about it did not die. Indeed, many of them appear to have been in no actual danger of dying. And those who have reported leaving their bodies during a true medical emergency, after cardiac arrest, for instance, did not suffer a complete loss of brain activity. Even in cases where the brain is alleged to have shut down, its activity must return if the subject is to survive and describe the experience. In such cases, there is generally no way to establish that the NDE occurred while the brain was offline. Many students of the NDE claim that certain people left their bodies and perceived the commotion surrounding their near death, the efforts of hospital staff to resuscitate them, details of surgery, the grief of family members. Some subjects even say that they learned facts while traveling beyond their bodies that would otherwise have been impossible to know. For instance, a secret told by a dead relative, the truth of which was later confirmed. Reports of this kind seem especially vulnerable to self-deception, if not deliberate fraud. There's yet another problem, however. Even if true, such phenomenon might suggest only that the human mind possesses powers of extrasensory perception, clairvoyance or telepathy, for instance. This would be an astonishing discovery, but it wouldn't demonstrate the survival of death. Why? Because unless we could know that a subject's brain was not functioning when the impressions were formed, the involvement of the brain must be presumed. What is needed to establish the mind's independence from the brain is a case in which a person has an experience, of anything, without associated brain activity. From time to time, someone will claim that a specific NDE meets this criterion. One of the most celebrated cases in the literature involves a woman, Pam Reynolds, who underwent a procedure known as hypothermic cardiac arrest, in which her core body temperature was brought down to 60 degrees, her heart was stopped, and blood flow to her brain was suspended so that a large aneurysm in her basilar artery could be repaired. Reynolds reports having had a classic NDE, complete with an awareness of the details of her surgery. Her story presents several problems, however. The events in the world that Reynolds claims to have witnessed during her NDE occurred either before she was, quote, clinically dead, or after blood circulation had been restored to her brain. In other words, despite the extraordinary details of the procedure, we have every reason to believe that Reynolds' brain was functioning when she had her experiences.